I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There seems to be a new signpost in the road to the presidential elections. Plus, there's Ted Nugent, new debates over dogs. So let's take a quick check-in in politics to start. New polling from the Pew Research Center shows President Obama and the presumptive GOP candidate Mitt Romney will be spending billions of dollars on just about 7% of voters, the ones who are truly undecided. And both candidates are looking for those voters this week in Lorain, Ohio. Mitt Romney visiting a wallboard factory that closed down shortly after candidate Obama visited in 2008. And Romney went to Lorain specifically because President Obama was there yesterday and told a crowd at Lorain County Community College that he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Rick Klein is senior Washington editor for ABC News. Rick, these swing voters, so few of them, Politico is calling them the persuadables and identifying them as downscale Midwesterners, suburban women, and better educated, higher income white voters. What does it mean to you that there are so few of them?
There are fewer in each election, I think. It's a more polarized country. And when you really drill down on the demographics, I think that about gets it. I think even more broadly, we're talking about white middle-class voters. They live, obviously, in battleground states. That's the only ones that matter. Economically, they aren't upscale. They aren't quite poor. Majority white, because we know that the vast majority of minority voters are going to go for President Obama. The vast majority of upper-class voters are going to go for Mitt Romney. So it's a shrinking field, and actually visiting places like rural Ohio, that's a place that's actually relatively voter-rich in this kind of environment.
Well, Chris Chalizza of The Washington Post is writing about all this. He says the candidates are going to spend about $2 billion on these, you know, the 7% of the electorate. One, you know, thinks, well, why don't you just give them the money, you know? But he writes that they are so wed to their candidates, others are so wed to their candidates, they won't be able to be peeled away. What can the candidates say to peel away that 7%?
What I think is interesting is you're seeing the two arguments play out in much different ways. As you referenced, President Obama says, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I think that is a direct reference to Mitt Romney's background. That's how I read it, and saying his background is more indicative of his proposals and the president's proposals to help have government help people get a leg up. And then Mitt Romney's coming back and saying something really interesting. He says, look, I think President Obama's a nice guy, but we just can't afford him, afford four more years of him. He's kind of looking past the personal backgrounds and saying, look, I know I can't connect with you, Mr. Voter, Mr. Downscale Voter, but I know that I have proposals that may work for you in terms of a free market economy and supporting small business jobs, that sort of thing. So don't be fooled by someone you might like more. And he's almost surrendering in the likability argument and just focusing entirely on the economy.
Okay, some of the other things that are out there in politics, some people say they reflect the silly season. Others say it's pretty darn serious, especially the flap over Ted Nugent's comments. He was speaking at the National Rifle Association convention. He was being broadcast to a lot of people who were standing around him and nodding in agreement with things he was saying. He said conservatives need to chop the heads off certain Democrats that he named in November. And then if President Obama gets reelected, he, Ted Nugent, will either be dead or in jail by this time next year. Some people heard that as a threat. The Secret Service is questioning him today about it. The Romney campaign came out and said that they think that negative comments from both sides are bad. Democrats are saying that's not forceful enough. Ted Nugent is a big Romney supporter. Your thoughts?
I think there is a silly season around celebrity surrogates. I think this is even different than Hillary Rosen saying things about Ann Romney. She's at least an advisor to the Democratic National Committee. I think in Ted Nugent's case, he's an aging rocker who happens to be involved in politics. Mitt Romney likes the celebrity star power, as a lot of politicians do, but I don't think it's fair to hold him responsible for everything he says. I think when Ted Nugent he's going to be now questioned by the Secret Service, I can't imagine they find an actual threat there. And I think short of other things Mitt Romney says or people closer to him say, I don't see much of a scandal in having a celebrity say things that are pretty outrageous.
Well, then you're not going to care that much about dogs. So we'll just take 2 seconds
not to true.
Say that.
I do care about that.
Well, I mean, just in the few seconds we have, Mitt Romney's and his wife Ann Romney speaking to Diane Sawyer, not apologizing for putting Seamus in the crate on the roof, and others digging out comments that Barack Obama made about having once eaten dog as a child in Indonesia. Is this going to blow over? Please tell me it is.
I think it's losing its bark, and I think in part that's in part because there's now an effective response for the Seamus thing about the roof on the roof of the car. Now Republicans come back and say, "Well, your guy actually ate a dog."
Oh boy!
And so maybe okay. The silly season this cancels itself out.
We can hope. Rick Klein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts is introducing legislation today to extend an existing award to anyone who gives information leading to the arrest of warlord Joseph Kony. The timing coincides with tomorrow's call for action against Kony. Tomorrow is April 20th, the day that popular Kony 2012 video asked people to put up posters calling for the arrest of the warlord whose Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda in the 80s and 90s abducted tens of thousands of children and forced them to be child soldiers. The video had some controversy. The filmmaker Jason Russell was found outside his San Diego home, naked and ranting, after the film was criticized. A Ugandan journalist we spoke with said the video was out of date because Joseph Kony is no longer in Uganda, and besides, Ugandans are leading the search for him. Russell's charity, Invisible Children, responded, saying that since leaving Uganda for Central Africa in 2008, Joseph Kony's LRA has killed over 2,400 people, kidnapped over 3,400, and the Washington Post reports this week that in just the last year, Joseph Kony's army displaced nearly 500,000 people, and people in the region still live in fear. So, ahead of tomorrow's postering, what is true about Joseph Kony and child soldiers? Jo Becker works on children's rights at Human Rights Watch. She's going to join us shortly. But we want to start with Grace Akalo, here with us in the studio, a former captive of Kony's army. She co-authored the book Girl Soldier, A Story of Hope for Northern Uganda's Children. She's now executive director of United Africans for Women and Children's Rights. And Grace, we want to welcome you, and we want to hear about your experience. But first, your thoughts on Kony 2012. You've told us that Invisible Children made previous films and organized marches that drew attention to the plight of children who feared being abducted. You applaud that. But you feel what about the video Kony 2012?
The video is not updated. They should have said Joseph Kony is not in Uganda now, but still we have to know that Joseph Kony still exists in Eastern Congo and is still committing the atrocities, abducting children in Eastern Congo, is still raping women in Eastern Congo.
Let's talk about that aspect of this, and I know it's very difficult for you, but even before you were abducted, you lived in a sleepaway Catholic finishing school.
Yes.
And as students, you were told occasionally to grab blankets and run into the bush and hide because there was this monster preying on children. It must have been terrifying.
It was very scary. Every night you have to be Sister Akele or Sister Alba from the headmistress of the school who come and say, girls, we have to run right now. We have to go hide because it's not safe. There's rumors that the Lord's Resistance Army are coming this way.
Well, and then they did come
in
1996. And you've told about them being at the window, shining flashlights into a girl's terrified eyes, seeing you guys inside, and taking you away. You didn't even have words for some of the things that were done to you.
No, I can't. I can't explain with the common language that we use, except I don't even know how to speak about it. It was horrible. What they did to us is what should never be done to any human being, whether an adult or a child. Now, if that is done to a child, how much is it going to affect the child for the rest of their lives?
Forced marches were just the beginning of it. As you say, you didn't have the words that you've come up with, that you young girls were given as wives.
Yes.
Many of you to the soldiers. Forced to kill?
Yes.
In one scene you describe, you were forced to beat another smaller girl.
Yes.
And you didn't hit her hard enough.
Yeah.
So it was demonstrated on you?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is hard. It takes a toll on the child. By the time the child returns home, the child's psychology is not at the normal place. And at that point, the child needs really rehabilitation to be able to continue to be in the society.
Okay, now we should say there are tears in your eyes. So I think, we get the point that, this was just, it's unimaginable. And as you've just done, we're going to move to your concerns about what happens to these kids afterwards, because you were one who escaped. They thought you were dead at one point and buried you in a shallow grave.
Yes.
And you escaped.
Yes.
what does happen afterwards? I mean, I can't even imagine. Just start with the nightmares. I mean, what is life like afterwards?
It is very hard. When I first came back, everybody else, I blocked them out, including my parents. I could not talk to anybody. The only person that got to me was Sister Alba. Then she did not call me to tell my story. She just called me to tell our own stories. And then from that way, we started building building friendship and trust. And that way, it helped me to start talking about myself to her. But at the same time, the children, it's not just about talking. The resources to make sure that these children go back to normal life, that they have a second chance to go to school, that they have a home to live and, you know, have a future is very important. Because if you know that you have a future, you work hard. But if you don't, it's hard.
Are they stigmatized? I mean,
a lot. In the earlier years, it was even more when you escape from the LRA. Sometimes the community would decide to beat you or kill you or report you that you're a rebel. We were scared of the community and the Ugandan soldiers because we were told they would kill us.
Because even though you've been abducted, you had fought. I mean, we talked about you being forced to beat another girl, but you were also forced to go out and fight soldiers.
Yes. And so when you come back, it's very hard to rejoin the community.
And some of the girls who returned were pregnant.
Not just pregnant. They have two or three more kids, a whole of, let's say, family now, with no skills and rejection from the community. Hard to bring up those kids, which are also a reject in the community. It's very tough.
Well, I mean, I know we're really hopscotching through your story because it is so incredible, because not only, you know, the arc we've just described, but you also found yourself in the United States speaking before Congress, meeting politicians. What do you want to have happen? What do you want people to do?
At first, when I came to this country, I was desperate, really desperate. I wanted Joseph Kony to stop because there was killing, burning people in the camps, abduction had increased, and there were no schools, and they had started using tactics of killing the teachers and cooking them and giving them to kids. So I wanted Joseph Kony to stop. I just wanted him to disappear anywhere. So I wanted anybody who could listen to hear, and anybody who could do anything to stop Joseph Kony. And at that time, also few people knew about it. But now, knowing that Joseph Kony is no longer in northern Uganda, the absence of gun doesn't indicate that there is peace in the region. My concern is the child soldiers and the children who are affected by this conflict, they need to get resources. The resources should be channeled to make sure that they're given a second chance to contribute to themselves and to the community that they live in.
Grace Akalo, captured by Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda at the age of 15, forced to be a child soldier. And as we just heard, she now wants the focus to be on others who have survived that. Now we also want to bring in Joe Becker, who works on children's issues at Human Rights Watch. And Joe, you've been listening to Grace. People might think that what she's saying can't be possible, you know, children forced to do unspeakable things. So how widespread is the use of child soldiers? And we ask especially since the Kony 2012 video, which is calling for people to put up anti-Joseph Kony posters tomorrow, was criticized because Kony is no longer in Uganda, where Grace was abducted. So are there still child soldiers?
There are. The Lord's Resistance Army is probably one of the most extreme and brutal examples, but it's not an isolated phenomenon. There are currently about 14 countries around the world where child soldiers are still being recruited and actively fighting.
What are some of the countries?
A lot of people have a conception that child soldiers are really an African phenomenon, but in reality, that's not true. There are many child soldiers in Asia, for example. In Afghanistan, the Taliban uses children. In Burma, the government uses large numbers of boys in its national army. In India, the Maoist rebels use children. There are children being used in the Philippines and Thailand, and also in Colombia. Children serving in the FARC and the ELN, the guerrilla groups.
Well, and we understand one of the reasons that child soldiers are so perfect for these manipulative leaders is that they can be manipulated, and Grace, that they also are trusting. Is it true that Joseph Kony would tell children like yourself that he would coat you with a protective oil that would keep bullets from penetrating you? And
it's called shea nut butter. Then there's a big ritual that is performed. But the main thing is when Joseph Kony says he knows your thoughts, he knows that you're thinking of escape before you even start thinking about it. So the kids like me, I try to stop thinking. I'm scared it's going to get me. And it's not a threat, it's not a joke. They bring people and they kill them in front of you and they say they were thinking of escape, or they escaped and they brought them back and they kill in front of you.
And Joe Becker, I mean, the hideous thing about the butter that Grace just mentioned is that the children would believe then that they were protected and march off into war, and of course they'd get killed by bullets. Do you see right. that kind of thing replicated in other countries?
Yes, and the fact of the matter is children make very easy targets for military recruiters. They're more vulnerable to brainwashing, they're easy to manipulate, less likely to question what they're told. We also see that children often will join armed groups as a form of survival. When communities start to break down in war, when schools stop functioning, when children are driven from their homes or their families because of conflict, sometimes they will join armed groups because they feel like it's their best chance of survival.
So what has the world community done about this?
10 years ago, the United Nations adopted an international treaty that prohibits the use or the recruitment of children under the age of 18. And today, 146 countries, including the United States, have joined this treaty. The use of children under the age of 15 is increasingly recognized as a war crime. Last month, we saw for the first time a conviction by the International Criminal Court of Thomas Lubanga from the Democratic Republic of Congo. So commanders that use child soldiers now are facing the stigma of being called a war criminal and the actual possibility that they could go to jail for decades.
Well, and we saw the Obama administration send some military forces to Uganda to help in the search for Joseph Kony. A lot of Americans, though, got a little nervous about that. As much as they hate the notion of child soldiers, they're not sure they want to be drawn into another war. Grace, your thoughts on that?
First of all, Joseph Kony is a very, very bad person, psychotic person. And to say that Obama is sending soldiers, you want another war, is not between countries. It's between this rebel leader that is abducting, killing, and mutilating people. But at the same time, I feel like they've sent them to Uganda, but the LRA are not in Uganda. They're in Congo. Uganda and Congo, they really don't have that good experience because Uganda...
They don't have good relations.
Good relations, yeah.
And Joseph Kony can sort of hide between these two countries. But I guess, Joe, the question to you, I mean, Grace just said it's not a declaration of war, it's a declaration of evil. What is your sense of how far countries can or should go to end the practice of child soldiers?
They have to do much more than they've done so far. Kony had an arrest warrant issued against him in 2005. There are generals in the Congolese army that have arrest warrants against them and continue to serve openly. There need to be efforts to bring these individuals to justice. And pressure against some of these groups to really demobilize the children from their forces. The Lord's Resistance Army is really at one extreme end of the continuum. Efforts to reason with Kony have failed, but there have been numerous other examples where both governments and rebel or opposition forces alike have actually signed agreements to release children from their forces and put them into rehabilitation programs, and we need to step up those kinds of efforts.
Well, that's the kind of thing that Grace is working on. I just, in the few seconds we have, so here we are, the eve before April 20th, again, the call from the Kony 2012 video was for everyone to plaster posters up calling for the arrest of Joseph Kony. Will you be putting posters up, Grace?
I don't know whether I'll be putting posters up. I want Joseph Kony to be captured. I want him to disappear. But at the same time, if all the resources are directed towards him, then what about the people who suffered under him? What kind of justice are they getting? Yeah. Even if we capture Kony today, what else? What is the next step?
And Joe Becker?
Maybe not posters, but we certainly have a wealth of information on our website about the need to bring Joseph Kony to justice, but also the broader need to address child soldiers on a global level, the challenges and the ways that we can do that.
I want to thank you both for talking to us about it. Quite something. Joe Becker, who works on children's rights at the Human Rights Watch. Grace Akalo, former child captive of Joseph Kony's army in Uganda. She co-authored the book about her experience called Girl Soldier, A Story of Hope for Northern Uganda's Children. She's now executive director of United Africans for Women and Children's Rights. Thank you, Grace. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you very
You're
much.
You're welcome. Our pleasure.
It's Here and Now. The war may be over as far as Americans are concerned, but the violence continues in Iraq. Today, emergency crews scrambled across Baghdad and several other cities to respond to explosions that killed more than 30 and injured more than 100. Iraq's bloodiest day since al-Qaeda's affiliate in the country, the Islamic State of Iraq, killed at least 52 people with a series of 30 blasts back on March 20th. The BBC's Rami Rukhayem joins us from Baghdad. And Rami, were the targets obvious? What was hit?
Security forces, as usual, were hit. There were many civilian targets as well. We actually visited an area in central Baghdad where we saw the site of an explosion. It was a car packed with explosives parked just outside an ordinary person's home. Nothing obvious about that. It's quite random, and many of these attacks are random. But there are also some obvious targets, such as, for example, Iranians who come to Iraq to visit revered Shia sites. And also, of course, police and the army.
Well, and we understand there were attacks outside of Baghdad. Was there any significance to the geography of some of these attacks?
Many observers immediately start looking at the sectarian identity of different cities that have been attacked. Unfortunately, this will not help in analyzing or understanding the situation because they are mixed. They are Sunni, Shia areas, Kurdish areas, all kinds of areas have been struck, and the sectarian makeup and the ethnic identity of these areas is no help in understanding the situation. The only thing that can be said about the geography of the situation is that whoever is doing these attacks is trying to say that they can carry out coordinated attacks across the country.
Well, and, you know, concerns were raised when American troops left at the end of last year that Iraq would fall back into a civil war, sectarian war, the ruling majority Shia with ties to Iran against Sunnis who were in power under Saddam Hussein. Is that what you're seeing?
Fortunately, not so far. We haven't seen anything like the sectarian violence that plagued the country back in 2006-2007, where it was very clearly a case of sectarian violence and almost cleansing areas by rival militias from their rivals. That's not what we're seeing. What we're seeing are attacks aimed at undermining the state, and they are targeting all kinds of different areas. It's quite different from what we saw, and it's important to remember that these kinds of attacks have never stopped in Iraq since 2003, since the invasion. In fact, we saw a marked increase in these attacks in the run-up to the withdrawal of American forces, and perhaps in comparison, what we're seeing today, it might be a little bit less than that, but still, it's very clear that whoever's doing this still can carry out coordinated attacks across Iraq.
Well, you say there are bomb attacks on a daily basis. It's just got to be nerve-wracking, to say the least. And we know Iraq is hosting another big meeting next month to talk about Iran's nuclear program. Iraq, we said, Shia-led at this point. Iran, of course, a Shia country. Bonds being formed there. Do you think some of this violence might be connected to that?
The last attacks, which you mentioned, came in the run-up to the Arab League summit, which was due in Baghdad, and that went ahead. It's quite possible because Baghdad is trying to reclaim a strong regional role for the country. They're trying to, by hosting such international events in the country, they're trying to say, we are back and we can play a role. We are no longer just a torn country where others play a role. We have something to do. We have something to say about events in the region and not just in Iraq. So these attacks do undermine that message that Iraq is trying to get across. However, as you said, it is nerve-wracking for Iraqis to live in a country where even tightened security measures do not prevent this kind of thing from happening.
I would say nerve-wracking might even not be the strongest word for it. I mean, your sense of just, you know, how are people feeling?
Well, people are very angry because security measures take a toll on their daily lives and still do not prevent this from happening. Road closures, blast walls, this kind of thing is part of the daily routine here in Baghdad, and it causes a lot of stress for people here, and all of this does not prevent the attacks from happening. So there is some anger among the population.
The BBC's Rami Rukhayem in Baghdad. Rami, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, have you seen the Yo-Yo Ma flash mob on YouTube?
Ooh, beautiful,
Actually, there are a few videos in this one. Yo-Yo performs America the Beautiful with Renee Fleming and several high school choirs in the Food Court Mall at Chicago's Thompson Center. These aren't really like regular flash mobs. After all, it's kind of hard to hide music stands and, in one case, an orchestra of cellos. But it's part of Yo-Yo Ma's citizen musician mission to create memorable moments of community. He came up with the idea as consultant for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. He's lived it with his cross-cultural Silk Road project and his cross-musical CD, The Goat Rodeo Sessions, which he recorded with violinist Stuart Duncan, bassist Edgar Meyer, and mandolin player Chris Thiele from Nickel Creek. Which makes us wonder why Yo-Yo Ma has come to our studios. Are we suddenly going to be surrounded by opera singers and bluegrass musicians? Will a YouTube video break out? Yo-Yo Ma, welcome.
Robin, thank you for the introduction. I only came here because of you.
Oh, you go on. Okay. You come here because you want to spread your message about music. And I just want to ask you about these flash mob. Do you watch YouTube videos at all? Have you seen any?
Occasionally. Actually, you know, what's interesting is I love YouTube videos, and there's such a treasure trove of not only things going on today, but actually people have put in clips of classics in film, in music, and you could actually look at the history of music from 1900 on.
There's the group that sings the Hallelujah Chorus in the food court, and then there's the University of Northern Iowa interlude dance. If you have not seen that, you should.
Okay.
But now there you are, Yo-Yo Ma on YouTube. You know, you've been on the greatest stages. There you are in a food court.
Well, I got to tell you, after you've had children and you've done show and tells, it doesn't matter whether you're between the four walls of a concert hall or you're in someone's living room or you're playing for a child who's trying to take your bow away and eat the hair and the bow and, you know, or getting an adult to play an instrument to try and, you know, hear the instrument close up and to draw the notes from open strings, from the cello, and feel the vibrations. I think there's so many ways you can give the sensations of music, but then along with the sensations, images, feelings, thoughts.
You're involved with a mentoring program in Chicago, trying to bring music into the inner city. You've brought the music into, I think, prisons, detention centers. Do me a favor right now. You've got this gorgeous cello here. Let's say I'm somebody, you're coming into one of these places, I'm someone who's not heard a cello or classical music before. Can you, in, let's say, 45 seconds, make me fall in love with a cello?
Sure. I will play something for you for 45 seconds.
So I have a cold coming on, which always makes me vulnerable, but I think I'm going to cry.
Well, Robin, I'd love to ask you, so what were you thinking about?
I was thinking, I've heard this, and then I've never heard it before. I felt like I'd never heard it before, and I can feel it in my chest.
Mm. What were the emotions? Strange,
just,
new,
just,
old,
I love
whatever?
This. I love this. But mm. I love this. What do you get from someone who may never have heard it before?
What's interesting is there's no wrong answer. In fact, I actually played this for Gert Kirshner in her hospital room.
We should explain. That's the wife of your mentor, Leon Kirshner, one of the great composers of all time. Leon recently died, and she's dying, and it's in a hospital room. What was that like for you?
Well, I said, you know, can I play something for you? And she said, yes. And then what was great, she said, I would like some pickles. So I ran out, bought some pickles, gave it to her, and she...
So much for your cello playing. Yeah. I really like a pickle.
It's exactly. So, you know, I mean, it's... That exists. This piece of music exists on West Wing. I was asked to play it at Steve Jobs' memorial service. It could mean a lot of things. To me, it's about flow. People think water, spring, something living, and most of all, I think it's something that is energized and it activates the air molecules and turns into sound. It lives in somebody else. And the physical reaction that you had is exactly what I'm hoping might happen when you hear something like that.
I mean, you talked about the air moving. Well, the air did move. It was, there were sound, I could feel sound waves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because that's a physical thing. You know, your skin is very responsive to sound movement in the air, and it really does literally touch you physically. These types of instruments have a certain kind of intensity or richness to the sound that actually moves a lot of air. These are acoustic instruments, mm-hmm. and they're designed to be able to project sound with integrity over distance. Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah, I felt it.
It's doing what it's designed to do.
It's Here and Now. Welcome back to our visit with Yo-Yo Ma, who's been on a mission of sorts to use music to grow better citizens. He and Renee Fleming recently went into Chicago schools to mentor students. And of course, he's been going way beyond the concert halls in his Silk Road project and his latest project, the Goat Rodeo Sessions. That's Quarter Chicken Dark, performed by Yo-Yo Ma, Stuart Duncan, Edgar Meyer, and Chris Thiele. Now, goat rodeo, it's Appalachian slang. It means, I had to say this, pilots use it too. It means that it's miraculous when something doesn't mess up. And Yo-Yo, you know, that could be the case when you throw different musicians together. You play with some of these. Some of them are bluegrass stars. But this isn't bluegrass. What is it?
Well, it's whatever you think it is. And someone actually described it. We thought it was wonderful. Someone said, this is a genre-proof kind of music. Because not genre-bending, but genre-proof. Because it's what I think good music is. It's always an amalgam of different things. It obviously has classical elements in it. It has bluegrass elements in it. But really, what it is the four of us. It's the chemistry between four people who really like one another, really want to work together, and it's the product of many years of friendship with my friendship with Edgar Meyer, and Edgar's friendship with Chris Thiele, and Chris and Edgar's friendship with Stuart, and that's what you hear.
Well, and it works. By the way, Edgar Meyer, the great classical bluegrass jazz musician, the MacArthur Genius winner, I mean, it does work, but it's not a given that it will. And we understand that one other time when you worked with Edgar Meyer and the violinist Mark O'Connor,
mm-hmm.
We hear you're sailing along. You're thinking this is going swell, but the other two maybe not so much.
Absolutely. And this is the wonderful thing is that, you know, here I am. I think this has happened all my life. I think something's going great. And someone looks at me and says, it's not.
Really?
Yeah. And this is what is, I think, just a wonderful lesson on what people choose to listen to, what they're focused on. Edgar said, well, you know, it's not, the groove isn't good, the intonation is different, it's not good. And Mark hasn't said anything, which is dangerous, you know. And by the time they're both through, I realize, my goodness, you know, I'm obviously listening to very different things. And so it took many months to be able to develop the oral or listening skills to focus on what they're thinking are really good aesthetic decisions versus ones that, you know, that I thought were fine. I did something with a Renee Fleming, I think, at the Lakeview High School in Chicago. And Renee, we all know Renee Fleming is a great, great opera singer. She listened to them and said, you know, you guys are fantastic. But let me tell you something. Do you think about projecting your voice? And she says, can you go, you know, the kind of sound, the nasal sound that you make when you want to kind of really make something edgy. And in 45 seconds, she gave them something that there was just a huge improvement in their ability to project. And they were already fantastic to begin with. But I did something I thought was kind of neat with Meryl Streep in Beijing a couple months ago. We were sort of an American team bringing something that we do to
Oh,
Beijing.
To be a fly on that wall, but
and
go ahead.
So she had just flown in. We spent like 20 minutes working on something where she was reciting a Chinese poem and then reading a letter that I think Martha Graham was writing to another dancer. And we figured out what to do with music and performed it later on that evening. And I guess being able to improvise on something at a short moment's notice and to be able to trust one another enough to then go perform it in front. And we had never done anything together.
There is a vitality, a life force, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, that expression is unique. If you block it, it will never exist through any other medium, and it will be lost. The world will not have it.
That's a value. Right. That's a value that we can actually teach. The way that I think there's a value of being able to look at, let's say, imagination. Can you teach it? I think you can. And I think one of the things we're trying to do with public school kids is to say, yes, you have to have tests and do all of these things, which is very important. But how about using words or sounds or music to stimulate curiosity, to inspire the learning, and to teach disciplined imagination, because that really is part of what we're trying to get to in our workforce in this era, right? Innovation, flexibility, and compassion, empathy, imagination.
In other words, you know, what you do with the kids in the schools today, we're going to see in good citizens and people in the workforce in the future. Well, I'm told that I have to say goodbye. I'm appalled.
Well, what an incredible treat and privilege to be on your show.
Thank you so much. The pleasure was ours.
Thank you, Robin.
Why don't we do this? You have the cello. Is there something you can just play for us to say goodbye?
Sure.
Something that will startle me.
Okay.
Startle me.
I'm not sure anything can startle you because you've seen it all. But let me try.
Okay.
Okay.